Every day I'm out there doing what it takes to get between these drug-peddling scumbags and our nation's greatest resource, rich, blonde, teenage girls. So what does it take to keep my stamina up while fighting history's most futile war? Well, nothing short of the finest stimulants you can legally buy. I'm talking about Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend if you're feeling adventurous. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this splendid coffee to your home or office in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. All the convenience, none of the commitment. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Our greatest resource, young blondes who are so mad. I'm just so mad all the time. That's why I do drugs.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hola and gracias for downloading the next 196 project. We look back at classic flicks, or sometimes not so classic flicks, every Monday morning. If hearing about the 123 pictures that were ranked on the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists interests you, then go way back in our archives and enjoy some, many, or all of those. Heads up, spoilers are coming soon. I'm the fisherman who's unjustly accused of rampant drug trafficking, Ryan Ellis. And here's the clean-cut government official who, ironically, has a daughter who's hooked on all kinds of bad shit, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
You're also blonde, and you're also so mad.
So mad. I'm not a teenager, though.
I just can't explain why I'm so angry all the time. Great A student, great life, but I'm so angry.
I'm rich, and my parents love me. Ah!
Although you probably shouldn't judge people for having mental troubles, because obviously Carolyn does. And she reminds me, we've talked about this before, The Shining Book has a line in there where I think it's Wendy speculating about why Jack's an alcoholic, that he's just one of those people that when he took that first drink, it was a... inside of him, some kind of little lever went. He can't drink normally the way so many other people can. One needle, one toot, one drink, whatever. You're hooked. Okay, the coming attraction is trivia for this week's picture. Very serious, even though we're making some fun of it here. Traffic. I count 7 actors, including Benicio del Toro, in this movie, who won an Oscar while giving a primarily non-English language performance. How many of those movies have we previously covered?
I found 3.
You did?
Oh, no, I'm wrong.
Well, give me 2 of them.
Robert De Niro in Godfather Part 2,
mm-hmm.
Christoph Waltz in Inglourious Basterds,
mm-hmm.
and Holly Hunter in The Piano.
I guess that's probably fair. When you look on Wikipedia, maybe that's where you found it, too.
Yes.
She doesn't speak at all.
She uses American Sign Language, which I also noticed on Wikipedia, if you want to get nominated for an Oscar, do a performance in American Sign Language. It was all over that list.
John Mills, I think is his name, also won a supporting actor Oscar in 1969, I think it was, for Ryan's Daughter, or 71,
yes.
One of those years.
What's the one God is in the title? Shoot.
Children of a Lesser God.
Children of a Lesser God.
Well, she speaks. Marley Matlin actually can't speak. The point was supposed to be they speak a language, but not English.
Are you saying that people who use sign language aren't speaking, Ryan?
This question is really going off the rails here. My trivia questions have been tough lately. I can't think of good ones anymore. I can always go to the Oscars, especially for an Oscar movie like this, but I don't want to do that every time.
I feel like I got the question right with bonus points right now.
I saw that too, and I was going to include them, but thought no. But anyway, we have covered Godfather Part 2 and Inglourious Basterds, 2 of the more revered supporting actor winners of all time, too, in those 2 performances. Although, ironically, you could argue that they're both leading performances. De Niro, a co-lead with Pacino in that movie, and Waltz is in Inglourious Basterds as much as anyone else is, probably as much as Brad Pitt is.
You would never call him the lead simply because he's the villain.
I don't know if that's a good enough reason. But that's about agents and about the way they position these things. People have been nominated for awards or won awards. Anthony Hopkins, Silence of the Lambs, not a leading performance, but he won Best Actor for that. Okay, we'll talk a lot about the Oscars in a few minutes here. But first, I will say The War on Addicted People was released 20 years ago by USA Films, although our Blu-ray is by Universal. I'm a big Universal Blu-ray fan. I love the way they do them. If you have one, you know what I'm talking about. The way that, whew, that swoosh sound effect and the way they do their menus and everything. Really good. And that was just in time for Oscar credibility in late December 2000, our second 2000 drug movie, because we did Requiem for a Dream, which also came out, I think, around that same time in 2000. Traffic made a mint domestically and was also a hit worldwide, which I remember being surprised about because I saw it pretty early on in its run and thought, this movie's really good, but people were making it a blockbuster. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon also was a blockbuster around that same time too, and not a movie you'd expect to be a big hit. But since the movie's 20 years old, babe, you should probably remind people what it's about, so give them the Traffic skinny.
Cops and drug dealers duke it out in the miserable ongoing conflict known as the drug war. The nation's drug czar has to square the cavalier attitudes of the people in charge with his own daughter's struggles with addiction. Workaday DEA agents come painfully close to closing in on the highest tier of the drug trade just to have their witness murdered while in their protection. And a Mexican cop bends all the rules to help the cause only to discover that he's actually helping a rival drug cartel do away with their competition.
And that's Del Toro playing the supporting actor Oscar winner, Javier Rodriguez. Anyway, in a nutshell, on Traffic. Drug czar knows pretty much nothing about the illegal drug trade. He's the audience's cipher. That's probably why he's like that. But he's like a doe in the woods, doe, a deer, whatever. Doesn't know anything. A babe in the woods. That's the expression I'm looking
Cocaine
for.
Cocaine comes from Mexico?
Wait a second.
He was a judge
drugs
prior to this. He should know.
Are bad? Wait, I know drugs are bad. That one we all know, but it isn't really done justly and properly. Mexico's a haven for this.
He's the exposition czar in this movie.
Yeah. Although I think Michael Douglas is quite good, but more so by far in the second half, or even the last third of the movie when he becomes George C. Scott in Hardcore. If you haven't seen that movie, that's a tough one to watch. That was effectively remade as 8mm with Nicolas Cage. But the sequence in this movie where Michael Douglas is trying to track down Erica Christensen's character, Caroline, his daughter, very much a Hardcore thing when he's trying to find his daughter in that movie when she's in the porn business. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 93% of them like this film, 149 fresh, 12 rotten, for an average of 8 out of 10, and 85% of audiences. Those are pretty solid numbers, I would say. It was 15th at the 2000 U.S. box office. Again, surprising me. It wasn't a big budget despite the huge production, big cast, but Grinch was number one. We've talked about that a lot because we've covered a lot of movies from 2000 lately. Gladiator, which we covered a few months ago, was number four. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was number 12, and Requiem for a Dream, which we covered a few months ago, was 160th. No one really wanted to see that one the way they wanted to see Traffic. This film won four Oscars. Best Director for Steven Soderbergh. Supporting Actor Del Toro, we know that one. Adapted Screenplay by Steven Gagan, and the Editing by Steven Mirioni. And the one thing it didn't win was Best Picture. Gladiator took that home. I think we talked about that on Gladiator a few months ago. Wasn't a fan of that choice. I still am not. This is also the rare picture, and we talked about this, I think, on Adventures of Robin Hood a couple years ago, that won every award it was nominated for, more than one, because I think you mentioned The Blind Side in our trivia for that one. It was nominated for Best Picture and Best Actress, and it won Best Actress, so that qualifies too, but multiple winners. This had four wins, Jaws had three wins, all technicals, and Adventures of Robin Hood had three or four wins, but not Best Picture, the only thing it didn't win. And Traffic was nominated for the second AFI Top 100 list, which isn't surprising. A lot of good movies from the early 2000s were. All right, so you haven't seen this movie in a long time. I've seen it four, maybe five times now. It has been a while. It is complicated. It's complex. I think I understand the plot now after all these times. But what'd you think of Traffic?
I think Traffic holds up pretty well 20 years later, except for a couple of things. I think it's very much a movie of the year 2000. It's hard to criticize this since Soderbergh is actually responsible for setting all the trends of this time and place. And it's one of those films that was a victim of its own success because it was copied so much. But the film style does look a little dated now. It's a little preachier than it perhaps needs to be. It could do with a little more show and a little less tell in that regard. And my third point, it is so very, very ugly. It is hard to look at. The cinematography is an absolute dog's breakfast. That sounds like a lot of criticisms to wrap it up and say, it's a great movie. It has an amazing forward momentum. It's funny that the other Soderbergh film that we've covered is Contagion because it stylistically actually reminds me of Contagion quite a bit. But Contagion seems to have perfected what he was doing at the time, was kind of experimental, the way he told this story. And then by the time he comes back to do it in Contagion, and when did that come out? 2011. It's like he had perfected it. It deserves all the accolades it gets. I understand why it didn't win Best Picture, maybe because the look of it is hideous. It's a better film than Gladiator in just about every other way.
An old friend of mine said that he thought this movie didn't win the Best Picture Oscar just because of the look. Also, Gladiator was an audience pleaser. This isn't really. Okay, a few things I want to clear up that I've talked about in the other podcast for years now. I've mentioned them apropos of nothing sometimes in relation to this film. Now we finally cover this film. Erica Christensen as Caroline, I thought was a deleted scene. I watched all the deleted scenes yesterday to make sure of this. There's 25 minutes of them, and it is not. So it must have been on the commentary, which we don't have on the Blu-ray. It must have been the old Criterion disc I had. I think we got rid of that years ago. But I heard somewhere, and maybe it was Soderbergh talking with the writer on the commentary about how there should be another scene where Caroline runs away from the drug clinic, even after she says, I met this person and that person. And she does seem better. It's not like the, yeah, I'm a drug addict and I'm here and I'm going to get better. It's more like, I'm going to be better today. She does and says the right things in that last time we see her when her parents are there at the drug clinic. But the notion that she still runs away, maybe heartbreaking, maybe terrible to think of it. But that to me is the truism. I've got an addicted brother. Probably everyone knows somebody who's had some kind of serious drug problems. They don't get over it after, well, in her case, it's twice, but they don't get over it that quickly. Like we said earlier, Carolyn's got something broken inside of her. Not to say she can never recover, but I don't think it ends that easily. And I love the notion. It would be depressing as hell to see her run away again, because we see her run away the first time earlier in the film. And maybe that's what it was too. So I always said that there was a deleted scene. I was wrong. There isn't actually one where she runs away. It's just in the movie itself.
But every storyline does end on a beat with hope. We're not led to believe that she's never going to falter again. We know that she went to rehab once and ran away and failed that time. So we understand this is probably something she's going to struggle with her whole life. She doesn't seem like she's cured and happy and everything's fine at the end of the film. Even though the DEA agents and Don Cheadle's character, they failed spectacularly, but he's still trying and he manages to plant a bug in the dealer's house. And we see that Benicio del Toro's character gets what he wants, which is a baseball diamond. We can talk about the hypocrisy and the ridiculousness that a baseball diamond is going to protect his community from gangs and the drug trade. Erica Christensen grew up with everything. Everything, and she became a drug addict.
Yeah, but he doesn't know that. He has no idea that's true.
No, but
and also, his notion is that give the kids something else to do. I've always believed that. If somebody's got a drug problem, they're probably going to have a drug problem. They're going to find something. But if you're looking to keep them away from bad stuff, it isn't necessarily the only answer, but it is an answer to give them something else to do, especially at night.
I guess it's an answer that it will probably save a handful of kids. And if that's what it does, then yeah, absolutely. That's a good thing to have. And it's not even just the baseball diamond. He says he wants electricity in his neighborhood. So that's actually going to solve a lot more problems than being able to play baseball at night. I think electricity in your neighborhood is probably going to improve the livelihood of a lot of people in your neighborhood. But they all end on hope is my point. So you end on the part of her story where she has her parents' support. Her father has come around to going from the stern disciplinarian to just being her father and trying to give her the love that she needs and the understanding and whatever, the patience. Although you've seen yourself, and probably a lot of people have seen, parents absolutely lose their patience and eventually have to give up on children. Give up is the wrong word, but lose hope.
My brother's a lot older than Christensen is in this film. That's part of it. She's still a kid, effectively. But the big line that Douglas has in that scene is, we're here to listen. And if they really are going to listen to her and the other addicts talk and not try to be the judge that he is and the smart man that he is and the experienced person, but not experienced in this world, really, maybe a little bit more so now, but if he's not going to do the tisk-tisk finger wag, which I don't think he's going to, then that's going to help them at least in some kind of way.
And one of the things this film gets so very right, and I think a big reason why people love it and still respect it, is that it's not judgmental. It doesn't have answers. It's actually really open-ended and almost journalistic in the way that it's just showing you these stories. Maybe journalistic is the wrong word because I don't know how accurate it is, but in the sense that it doesn't appear to be taking a side one way or the other. Yeah, of course, drug dealers are wrong, but then they make a real case for this industry. It's going to survive no matter what. Mm. Somebody's going to make money off of it no matter what. I'm sorry, there's nothing you can do about it. You're not going to win by arresting dealers or closing the borders. The market is there. So
somebody will swoop in and take their business.
Yeah, somebody's going to fill this need in the market, and that's all there is to it. They do kind of land on the side of veering towards treatment as a way of fighting the drug war rather than attacking the dealers in the
arresting
market.
And killing.
Yeah.
A lot of the important drug guys, bosses or secondary bosses or whatever, important guys in the drug chain, are dead when this movie's gone. But it's like that line in the Simpsons episode we like so much. We saw it not long ago, the Beer Baron one, where he's out of business, but how long until you get this city drunk again? Homer says something like, I'm out of it, Mayor. And then right away, Fat Tony, 20 minutes. Something like that.
Yeah.
Next to no time. And that's something we'll talk about in the what happens next. I've got something about how that'll go down. You said journalistic a second ago. I don't think that's a bad word. Docudrama, maybe the better word for it. It's very much like that. It's not a documentary, but it comes across that way. I think there's got to be some stolen shots. When you see Benicio del Toro, and at one point goes right past Catherine Zeta-Jones, one of the rare times the major cast members have any sort of interaction, and they don't. They don't know each other. They're never going to meet each other in our storyline, but they do literally pass each other. But even more so when you see Erica Christensen walking through the downtown Cincinnati streets, the really hardcore drug area where she is. That felt to me like they just stole that shot, as they say. It wasn't actually permitted. That also really lends to the docudrama element. Speaking of permit, in the movie, I think a permit in Mexico means a bribe, which I guess it does in every country, but in this movie, at least, Mexico, that's what it means. Although Javier doesn't want a bribe. He's trying to help these people out, but telling them, this is the way it works in this country. I'm not looking for a bribe, but somebody is. Now, the thing I noticed this time in this movie, way more than anything else, and this certainly includes Javier, he knows exactly what he is, even calls himself a traitor, is how many rats and traitors are in this entire movie, especially in the San Diego / Mexico storyline. Not so much the Michael Douglas Cincinnati one with his daughter. But when we're dealing with Benicio del Toro and Jacob Vargas, Manolo is a rat. Javier is a rat to the DEA in America, but he's a Mexican, not a drug czar, but rising to the ranks. He was a cop to begin with. And for good reason. It's hard to judge him for it, but he is still a rat. Frankie Flowers is a rat. Dennis Quaid is. I didn't think I really picked up on that before, but I was reading the Wikipedia stuff on this before we sat down to record. He's the one that sold out Ruiz, Miguel Ferrer's character, which would get Carl made at some point, so he, Arnie, can take over Carl's business.
Well, there's a line when the thug is threatening her son in the playground. He says, your husband owes me $3 million. And then later, when the husband is out of prison and he's talking to Arnie on the phone, he says, you have that $3 million. It's a specific number, $3 million, insinuating that Arnie was holding on to that because he hoped that she would get taken out or that he would get taken out, probably more likely.
It also wasn't clear if she sleeps with Arnie.
He wants to.
Some of the deleted scenes, by the way, on the Blu-ray really do add some flavor to it. And we do see more scenes with Del Toro and Douglas. The major cast members don't interact almost ever. Del Toro and Douglas are in the same room together at least once. But one of the deleted scenes shows them having a conversation. Now, maybe Soderbergh didn't think he needed that scene. The movie's already 2.5 hours long. Or maybe the idea was we'll never actually have Del Toro and Douglas and Zeta-Jones. In other words, Mexico, San Diego, Cincinnati, they don't really ever truly interact. Del Toro and Douglas do in a way, but they don't really have a conversation per se. And some of the deleted scenes show some of these people interacting more. As far as the look goes, I didn't really address what you said a minute ago about that. I don't hate it as much as you do. I think it was an experiment that you were seeing around that time frame. The anniversary party, the JJL and Alan Cumming movie that they made was digital. That was one of the rare movies at that point that had been made digitally. And they weren't a big budget production, but they had a lot of big cast members. I think Kevin Kline's in it because so is Phoebe Cates. And yet people said, hey, it's great that you're trying this. This is going to probably be the future. Maybe people didn't even think that at the time. This could be the future. You've got major actors, but it looks like dog shit. Look where we are now. Look what Lucas and other people have done to make digital really work. I don't think Traffic looks as bad as some other movies around that time frame, like Blair Witch or even Anniversary Party, but it's not great. The one thing that does work well is that he does differentiate these storylines, Mexico, San Diego, and Cincinnati, with the different filters. Usually when you're in Mexico, it's a yellowish kind of look, sometimes even reddish, I guess. San Diego is fairly ordinary looking. I guess maybe red is one of the primary colors, and then blue in Cincinnati.
And that was the trend then, and Soderbergh is probably partly responsible. 2000 was a year that was rife with color wash overkill, and it was, like you said, an era for ugly movies. The integration of digital filmmaking was really exciting to filmmakers who both wanted to make films for much smaller budgets, but also for filmmakers who just like to do everything themselves, like Soderbergh, and enjoyed the flexibility of digital shooting. Of course, Traffic was not shot digital. It was amazingly shot on 35, which is crazy because I thought for sure watching it this time, the process they put it through added so much grain that it truly looks like it's 16 millimeter or worse. But it was taking part in this trend that was started by digital filmmakers, like the ones you mentioned. The whole Dogma movement in general was happening at this time. And they were making some really exciting stuff that just happened to be cheap and dirty and kind of look like shit. And I can see how that was a reflection of technology changing and something that was actually kind of exciting and happening at the time. But when you go back and watch these films, it was obviously a bad idea.
This was the first movie Soderbergh shot himself as Peter Andrews, using his dad's middle name, I think, and his mother's maiden name, something like that. But he's credited as Peter Andrews. I think he shot every movie since then, if not every single one, then most. And he's made a movie a year pretty much since then, despite the fact, I think we talked about this on Contagion, he was going to retire maybe 5-6 years ago, but he's still making major movies even now.
And it's totally possible that he was just in way over his head. he's an experimental filmmaker. He's always taking chances. I love that about him. And sometimes he totally falls on his face and makes something that is disappointing or just plain bad.
Full Frontal, 2 years later. Full Frontal had a big name cast, but cost next to nothing. He sent a letter to everybody, including Julia Roberts, who's in that. You're not going to get real trailers. I don't think they had trailers, period. But you're not going to get some luxe big thing that you're going to be able to live in for days on end while we make this movie. This is going to be truly down and dirty. That was after this big hit. Aaron Brockovich earlier this same year, big hit. Ocean's 11, huge hit. And then he does Full Frontal. That's just the kind of filmmaker he is, where he does those kinds of things.
And we love him for it, because that experimentation leads to sometimes some really cool, exciting stuff. And the things he learned while he was making Traffic, working with this huge cast, this really ambitious film, are probably the reason that Ocean's 11 got made. And certainly, like I already said, those lessons came back in Contagion, where he made an almost better version of this film, only about viruses instead of the drug trade.
Also similar great star-laden cast, but don't really ever interact. Some of them do, but even Kate Winslet and Lawrence Fishburne's characters only talk on the phone. They're never in the same room together that we see on screen, at least. I don't think so, right?
Yeah, and that's another film where the characters are really more archetypes than characters.
Which is true about this, too.
Yeah, and where it's driven so much by its forward momentum almost more than anything else, which he is so good at. He just makes such watchable films.
I mentioned a few times in this podcast, we cover Requiem for a Dream back in January, which is a totally different movie, but it is a drug movie. There have been a lot of great drug movies. Those are two of the best ones that have same time frame, really, same year. Goodfellas certainly stands out as a drug movie. And then Scarface, obviously, is Stephen Bauer, who is Carl in this. I like, by the way, he's Carl, not Carlo, like he probably would be, or whatever the Mexican equivalent of Carl would be. But of course, he's in Scarface. He's Al Pacino's buddy. Blow, the year after this, Johnny Depp, very underrated film, one of Ray Liotta's best performances. I always thought that was the character in Goodfellas, Come Home to Roost. Of course, Easy Rider, we covered years ago. It was a drug movie in its own way. Drugstore Cowboy, certainly is. We talked about that when we covered To Die For, because that's one of Gus Van Sant's other great films. Less Than Zero, back in the 80s, is about a guy who's badly addicted, just like Erica Christensen in this movie is. And spoiler alert, Downey's character, living the life he almost lived in reality, doesn't make it out of the movie. He dies. And there's a ton more you can mention, but when you talk about the great drug movies, if this isn't the best one, it's certainly right near the top. It isn't the most rewatchable, probably. Goodfellas is one I'll see on Netflix. I think it's still on Netflix, but it has been on Netflix. I think I should watch that again, but it's 2.5 hours long, so sometimes I don't have that much time to throw a movie in there. Traffic maybe isn't quite as rewatchable as that one is. Requiem for a Dream, as great as it is, you don't watch that over and over again.
No.
Like we talked about that a few months ago. But what would you say of the ones I mentioned, or maybe some other one in your mind, is the best drug movie? The one that's the one you should watch. And one more thing I'll say before you answer. I remember on Politically Incorrect when Bill Marcel had that show, and they were talking about Requiem for a Dream, and he said, that's not the drug movie to watch. Traffic is the drug movie to watch. And something about around that same time he mentioned about something had come up. I'll trust Roger Ebert's opinion. They're film critic, of course. I'll trust him about what he thinks about a movie. But Ebert loved both Traffic and Requiem for a Dream. I think Requiem for a Dream got 4 stars from him. So anyway.
They can both be good movies.
That's what I was thinking, too. They're so different. Yeah. I love them both. I'm not going to watch either of them very often. But anyway, your thoughts?
Well, of the movies you named, Goodfellas, come on, it's the best one. But I don't consider that necessarily a drug movie.
Right.
It's a movie where a character happens to have a drug problem, but it's really not the driving force of the film. You didn't mention the best drug movie.
Trainspotting.
Trainspotting, starring my boyfriend.
Which we covered as well. I forgot about that. Yeah, I just Googled them to write a few of them down, and that one either wasn't there. I just overlooked it. So Traffic was shot all over the place between April and June of 2000. Then, of course, it came out a few months later. It was in Ohio, obviously, California, obviously, Washington, D.C. You see Michael Douglas come out of the White House entranceway. I think they had to get permission, but not some kind of big drawn-out thing. It's just, it's Michael Douglas. He's been there before. And it was still during Bill Clinton's time in office, too. So he's just going to walk out, not even from the White House itself, just from the gates. And then he's walking down the street all by himself. And he, of course, was the president and the American president 5 years earlier. He has that great speech in that movie I've watched on YouTube many times, where he gives the big speech about don't besmirch my girlfriend and all that stuff. This movie, it seems like it's going to be the same kind of thing all over again. Maybe that's what Soderbergh was aiming for. And instead, it's, I can't do this. I can't wage war on my own family. He doesn't say my daughter's addicted, but he might as well. And then he just walks away. Not as great a speech as What's an American President. You're going to watch that on YouTube over and over again. But in an impactful way, it really has that. I like that element that this guy just basically breaks down. He doesn't start crying, but he gives up. And Harrison Ford apparently was in this role at one point, was working with Soderbergh on it. And I don't know why, but gave up on it. I like Ford. He probably could have pulled off most of the stuff. I don't know if he would have been as good in the hardcore type sequences, going through the streets of Cincinnati looking for his daughter, or even maybe at the very end where it's, I'm standing here at the lectern of the White House, but no, I'm defeated. I'm leaving.
don't know. I always find Ford a very sympathetic character. Like, he really conveys vulnerability very well. Michael Douglas, I wouldn't usually say that, but I think in this role, he does. He's a cipher for the audience. He's Mr. Exposition, but he has a great arc. And it feels really honest to me. I had forgotten this, even though I remember it being a really big deal for me when I first saw this movie. Saw the theaters, and I'm sure I saw it on home media after that. It was eerie to me how much Michael Douglas reminds me of my dad. He was a pretty strict disciplinarian when I was growing up, or at least he was a tough guy, and he wasn't somebody that I would have found it easy to be vulnerable with. But when push came to shove, he could really prove how much we mattered to him. He softened in his old age, and the man that you know is kind of like a pussycat. And just that dichotomy between the macho-ness and, I wouldn't say hyper-masculine, but the way that he's just an ideal man, right? And he's very successful in his field, and he feels like he's doing everything right. But meanwhile, his family is falling apart, and it seems like none of the things that he's supposed to do right, which is do his job well, support the family. Look, you're rich, you're successful, you go to private school. Why could you possibly have a drug problem? And what really ultimately works is him relating to his daughter on a much more human level. I love that storyline partially because it just rings really true to me and my family and my dynamic with my dad.
Your dad's also a very straight arrow, just like Michael Douglas' character is in so much of this.
Although he's a straight arrow, but the movie is pretty real about the fact that he has maybe a drinking problem.
He won't admit it, but he does.
He
accuses
so
his
much.
Wife of it. He says to his wife about how she's drinking too much, but she's the one that says you have to have a glass of scotch before you come in the door.
She says you have to have three glasses of scotch before you come in the door, and then they fight about it. He says, I need to have one, and it's only because you're boring. The most defensive thing that somebody would say because they have a drinking problem. They don't want anybody to tell them that they don't get to carry on with their behavior. You and I certainly drink, and I would be hard-pressed to give up the couple of drinks that I enjoy in the evening. I don't think I'm an alcoholic, but I do have a dependence on alcohol. So
but
maybe
it's legal.
But it's legal, exactly.
So it's different.
Yeah, it's different. But is it different? Although they never really show alcohol ruining his life in any way. They never see him getting drunk and acting out or anything or having health problems because he always has a glass of scotch in his hand. And that is true. You drink that much, even if you're not getting drunk, it's going to affect your health. It's going to shorten your life.
I think it's supposed to be subtle, though, the idea that he's got an addiction of his own kind, but it's not mentioned out loud. The wife, in a way, does, but it's still not a matter of, oh, this is a whole 5-minute subplot. She says that one thing. He fights back with a pretty mean thing he says to her about being dull. But we see him drinking with his assistant when he's leaving Cincinnati for D.C. We see him drinking at home. We see him wine, I think, scotch, all kinds of other things. So, yeah, it's a legal drug. And if that was invented today, just like sugar and ketchup and a lot of other things, cigarettes, they would not be legal if they were invented now. But heroin and coke and marijuana and the rest of them all had the benefit, or not the benefit, I guess, of being invented, whatever, popularized much later.
Yeah. The movie is pretty clear that every character in the film has an addiction in some way to one thing or another. Maybe they're addicted to their jobs. Maybe it's money and status or power or alcohol, even caffeine. There's a cartoon character called Spastic Jack that keeps appearing, and it's not like a real character. Spastic Jack is the toy that Catherine Zeta-Jones has made out of cocaine. Earlier in the film, we see Spastic Jack in a restaurant or something, and it's this big display, and there's all these coffee mugs. So I wonder if he's supposed to be a mascot for a coffee company or even something sugary, another addiction. Our lives are filled with addictive substances and behaviors.
Well, the focus in this movie when it comes to the actual end product, because we don't really see that in Breaking Bad. One of the few things about that show that's not perfect or not great, and this has been pointed out by a lot of people over the years, is that you don't really see people, well, maybe here and there, but rarely in that show do they ever really focus on the victims that Walter and Jesse are creating with their great product. But in this movie, we do see Carolyn freebasing for the first time. And you said the movie looked terrible, and I'm not saying it looks great, but I do love the way that he lit the scene, Soderbergh lit that scene, where she first does the freebasing. She leans back, and the tear comes out of her eye, and it's like she's saying, I'm home. And I think that scene is lit perfectly. You could do it a lot of ways, and maybe Roger Deakins would make it look 20 times better. But I love the way that one scene looks. Also, Seth makes a move when she's messed up, and later on he says in the hotel, I want us both to do a hit and then come at the same time. Maybe in that case, she's more willing. It's hard to say if they've ever had sex before that first time when she does the freebasing, and then he clearly is, raping might be a little strong, but he's taking advantage of somebody who's not really able to consent. Maybe they've had sex before. The movie isn't clear about that, but it's not really her boyfriend, per se, at that point, I don't think.
No, they're boyfriend-girlfriend.
Are they clear about that? Okay.
I always took it that they were a couple and they were probably having consensual sex prior to that, they seem like they have that kind of comfort level with each other. But what's interesting is that you rarely see him partake. He doesn't freebase when she's freebasing. And when they go to that motel room, he does it all for her, but he doesn't take any himself, I don't think.
Another deleted scene, though. He talks with Douglas about being able to do this casually on the weekends. Some people can do any of these addictive things we've just talked about casually. I know it might sound weird, but probably even heroin or crack, coke, all these kinds of things. Well, we know people can do coke and not be truly addicted. Look at the Hollywood celebrities who have been doing it for decades and they're still living. Although maybe with a lot of money, you can survive that differently. Anyway, the point is he literally says to him, I can do it on the weekends and it doesn't really bog me down. I can do my schoolwork.
Lots of people are like that. And I think even more so when you're young. I used to just drink on the weekends. I could go weeks without drinking. I can go weeks without drinking now. I'm making myself sound like an alcoholic.
But you did go weeks without drinking.
I did, yeah. When I had COVID.
Now you don't. Then you did.
Oh,
too,
yeah. First, but yeah. I mean, I went 3 weeks without drinking. I'm not saying that I wasn't like, ugh, I really would like a drink, but I wasn't like having DTs or something. But when I was younger, I used to just drink on the weekend. I used to drink exactly the same amount, but I would squeeze it into one night or two nights, as opposed to now when I never get drunk, but I have a drink pretty much every day.
You get drunk sometimes.
I get drunk sometimes. Okay. Rarely do I get drunk. Drunk enough not to drive, I guess.
We'll come back to the Cincinnati people in a second, but the movie does start and end with Javier. You see the drug bust in the desert with him and Manolo, and then right away Salazar swoops in, takes the drugs away. That guy's a weird actor, but in a good way. Thomas Milian, I guess I say his name. He'd been working for something like 4 decades before he even made this movie. It was towards the end of his career. You could tell he's an older actor. And what an arc for him, too, because he acts like he's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to stop the drug trade, but then he just wants to take over somebody else's business. But Javier starts the movie with the drug bust and then ends the movie, the last scene we see before the credits roll, and during the credits for that matter, when he's watching the baseball game. Another thing I'm sure I heard in the commentary at one point, is he dead? Is he watching this from heaven? Because this is not a guy who's going to live very long doing what he's doing. Even though he's a cop and he's been doing the right thing as much as possible, he's trying to be a good cop. He thinks he's going to get whacked for being a rat, but he manages to survive, even though he's going to be a rat later on. He even says so to his American counterparts. I feel like a traitor.
Plus, he pretty much ratted out a huge guy in the drug trade, so there's going to be some retaliation. That's a good point. I never thought that's him watching the baseball game from heaven, but yeah, he probably doesn't have that long to live. That's unlikely to remain a happy ending for him.
Two movies in the span of a couple of years, and I watched the other one after this one because we talked about it when this was over, so I had to see it again, play a great piece of music by Brian Eno, An Ascending or The Ascending, various titles I've seen. I think it's An Ascending is what it's credited in this movie as. But it's at the end of this film when Del Toro's watching the baseball game, and it's during the sequence when they're riding out of London to try to find the military guys, where that movie really starts going downhill. And 28 Days Later, that angelic take you away. It's almost like an Enya song in a way, too, without Enya lyrics. It has that same kind of feel. Miguel Ferrer, who's George Clooney's cousin, incidentally. And, of course, Clooney had already worked with Soderbergh on a movie we saw not long ago, Out of Sight. You and I watched that on our DVD a few weeks ago. And Clooney started working with Soderbergh there. Then, of course, in Ocean's 11 and Solaris and many other films they've made together over the years. They've been friends for a long time. But Ferrer, I don't think, worked with Soderbergh a lot. But in this movie, he's one of the better things in it, I think. He has that scene towards the end where he talks about how, what was the big deal? My drugs just got through. Someone's going to just replace me anyway. I'm a dead man and all this kind of thing. And, of course, he does end up dead by being poisoned.
I love him. He's one of my favorite things in the movie. Him and Topher Grace are like the smart-ass truth-tellers of the film who are bratty, but... They're right.
They're very right. Topher Grace with Michael Douglas when he says, what do you think it's like for the black people to have white kids like me, rich white kids come into their neighborhood from the suburbs saying, hey man, you got some drugs? If the rules were reversed, then white people would be selling drugs in a minute.
He's the one that pretty much points out one of the main themes of the film, which is the supply is never going to go away as long as the demand is there. And of course, his argument is about how the demand keeps coming to the black neighborhoods. So of course, they're going to be the people who take that up.
But as far as the drug bust at Ruiz's place early on, when he ends up in the ball pit and has his foot shot by Don Cheadle, I love the Don Cheadle, Louis Guzman chemistry, by the way. They had been in Boogie Nights a couple years before this, and they probably share a few scenes together, but not specifically that I can remember. No big scenes. But here,
and
they're partners.
As well together, but I don't think they share a scene.
But here, Guzman and Cheadle are partners for a little more than half the film. And then Montel, Cheadle, is more motivated towards the end because his friend got killed. But during that drug bust, it's interesting to see there's no communication between the DEA guys, Cheadle and Guzman and their people, and the local cops. Now, I guess the local cops are maybe what Dennis Quaid's character, Arnie, set on this. I'm not really sure how that exactly worked, but they happen to come in at the same time. Maybe that's supposed to be some kind of suggestion Soderbergh's making and Stephen Gagan, the writer. Even in this organized type of drug bust thing, just like in the Mexico drug bust in a way, because you got local cops who've done their job, they've stopped the shipment of drugs, but then some big boss comes in. No, I'm taking that away. And they're going to work for me later on as we learn as the movie plays out. But that's not exactly a textbook drug bust either, because they take the stuff, but then other people take it from them. And they even take their handcuffs, and these guys have no money. They got to pay for their own handcuffs. I think it's the suggestion there. But during that Ruiz bust, regardless of why it happened exactly, you've got people aren't speaking to each other, and it could have easily gone really bad. People did get shot and hurt, and yes, a few of them could have been killed. Montel was shot, but like in all movies, he just gets up and he keeps on going, even though he should be down for the count. Bulletproof vest or not, his ribs are probably broken from that. I haven't really talked that much about Catherine Zeta-Jones in this film, who, again, deleted scenes. I like her performance more than I ever did before, having seen those just yesterday. People thought she was screwed out of an Oscar nomination for this, for Best Supporting Actress. I didn't think so. I think Erica Christensen was. I think Christensen's never been better than she was in her, I think, second movie, and certainly her first major movie. I think she's outstanding as a 16-year-old, but she's actually 17. So she's basically playing her right age. Something like Upset of Anger, a movie I like a lot, really good cast, but she's not good in that movie. She seems like she's, I think we talked about this recently, or at some point we've talked about this before, maybe James Franco in Spider-Man 2. In some of his movies, he's so acting. Can you see the acting? And Christensen in that kind of movie, you can just see her not being real. But in this movie, she seems like she really is. And again, kudos to her, because if she's walking through the Cincinnati streets and they're stealing shots, and maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe they had a permit. Maybe they were all actors. But here's a little blonde white girl walking through this tough neighborhood, even with a movie crew behind her and maybe a van with a camera pointing out of it. But anyway, I think she was screwed out of an Oscar nomination for some of the great things she does. Zeta-Jones, not so much. I never liked the moment where Arnie says to her, he whispers, "Your husband's the biggest drug trade, whatever, whatever, in San Diego." And that look she gives him, which was in all the trailers. I always thought, that seems, again, like she's acting the moment. But when you see her performance fleshed out more in the deleted scenes, I liked it even more. Now, that isn't part of the canon of the movie, granted, because they are deleted scenes. But I liked her in general, seeing this movie again more than I had before anyway. And she actually was pregnant with Michael Douglas's kid. They got married soon after the filming of this movie. So when the Oscars came up and Douglas comes out to announce Best Picture, again, that same friend, I remember him saying, "Oh, he's all ballsy. He's going to say Best Picture, Traffic, my movie," as it turns out. Instead, it's Gladiator. I wouldn't say Douglas gave it away. He was disappointed, but he must have been. But then he got to announce that Zeta-Jones' movie, a movie she won an Oscar for, Chicago, won Best Picture 2 years after this. But as far as Helena goes, interesting, again, you've got Carl rather than some kind of Hispanic name, and then David, which is a very American name, not a Mexican kind of name.
Well, they're the rich people, the white people.
I guess that's right,
as Luis Guzman says.
And I think she's supposed to be, as she is in reality, Welsh, because she says something in the first scene we see her with her friends, that she's from Europe, not from Mexico.
And she says to her husband when he's in prison, "I will not be poor again." Wales, notoriously very working class. She probably came from absolute abject poverty and found herself here. And we learn just how much she will do to make sure that she remains wealthy. Although, when you want to talk about what happens next, do you think they ever end up in prison, her and her husband? They came real close.
We'll get to that later on.
All right.
We'll answer that question.
Okay.
But I do want to know, how did Helena not know about Carl's business? Because in that moment where Arnie whispers in her ear and she looks back towards him with that stunned look, is it a reference to Kay and The Godfather? Is it willful ignorance that she doesn't know any of this? And I don't think the movie's suggesting that she's lying to people, including Arnie, that she doesn't know. I think she honestly did not know. And how do you not know this at all? Except Breaking Bad and The Godfather did suggest that their husbands were doing a lot of really illegal things, and their wives, for a time at least, did not know. Is that what it maybe is, a reference to The Godfather?
If she didn't know, then I just don't buy what happens next, which is, of course, her taking his place. And having the cojones to go down to Mexico and talk to these drug lords and convince them to keep using her product, completely hold her own like a badass when he wants her to try drugs. And she's like, "No, I'll walk away. I don't care. I'm 6 months pregnant. I'm not doing that." And they give in to her. The confidence and the competence with which she carries out her husband's business after that, I just don't buy it. So maybe she's putting on a face for his business partner. Maybe she's worried about who could be watching and wants to appear to be innocent to anybody who might have a set of eyes on her. "I had no idea. What? That's where my husband's money came from?" But I don't know. I don't buy it.
The movie's really subtle if it's saying that she did really know. Because at some point we should be let in on that, and we never are.
It could just be a bit of a stretch on the part of the writers, too.
Well, the San Diego stuff is my least favorite in the whole movie. Not that there's anything wrong with it. If the whole movie had been Catherine Zeta-Jones, Don Cheadle, Louis Guzman, Stephen Bauer, and Dennis Quaid, if it had been the five of them and some other actors, I would have enjoyed that movie just fine. And, of course, Miguel Ferrer, for that matter. But I did prefer the Cincinnati stuff and even the Mexico stuff more than the San Diego stuff. There's that good scene where Helena gives lemonade to the DEA guys. So Cheadle and Guzman are staking out her house. I think that's supposed to be based on reality, but she does also mention their kid was threatened not long before that. Reminds me of that whole Trump thing with one of his goons to Stormy Daniels. That's a pretty kid there you got. It'd be a shame if something bad happened to it. God, that's pretty much what they do in this movie.
Yeah, it's another great scene where she's just demonstrating how fearless she is.
But then, of course, she is involved in the red letter scene in this film, and it was the poster, I think. It was the only poster shot at first. It wasn't the actress' faces, I don't think. It was that shot of Frankie Flowers being gunned down from behind with his arms stretched out in the air as he's right outside the fence line where he's trying to shoot Ruiz. But she's the one that's telling him to get out of the car and shoot him right in the head. But then Ray gets car-bombed soon after. A lot of things happen in that moment. And it's a pretty tragic thing, too, because of Cheadle's reaction to his buddy getting blown up. He notices, oh my God, something's wrong, but he can't stop him from starting that car and blowing himself up. And at the end, of course, he picks a fight in the house so he can plant the better bug. And he gets that small measure of satisfaction. One of the rare smiles he has in the movie when he runs away, realizing, oh, now we've got a better bug. But that's nicely set up earlier because he's bitching at Guzman for the bug that they planted. We don't see that happen. But
yeah, he says the bug's in the wrong room.
But now it's right under the desk. And one of the deleted scenes, yet again, another one, where you see Montel listening to a conversation Carl has on the phone. And Carl says, now I'm untouchable. Well, obviously, he's very touchable if they can get more evidence on him. It's not like it's double jeopardy, which apparently also is bullshit, that movie where you can't be tried for killing your husband twice. If he's found that he did something with the drug trade again and they've got evidence, we can go to court again and be tried again with different witnesses.
But as Ruiz says, cut their head off, another head will grow back in its place. He has that great speech where he says, you guys remind me of those Japanese soldiers stuck on a deserted island that have no idea that the war is over.
Yeah, the unwinnable war. You see the senators in this movie, real senators playing themselves. None of them actually, I don't think, say this war can't be won, but they're implying it.
They're also implying drug enforcement is part of the reason why the violence gets so ugly. I don't think a lot of murders happen in the interest of selling alcohol, even though alcohol is, by and large, the most popular drug. I guess coffee, but whatever, coffee, alcohol, tobacco. People don't generally get killed in this industry, but any drug that is illegal involves tons of murders. One of the politicians makes that point. Well, the violence is because we're enforcing this. It's because they need to keep everybody afraid to snitch on them or this or that, and they have to keep everybody in line, and that's why the murders happen.
And Frankie Flowers, when he's caught and tortured with that awful thing in his nose, that nasal spray thing, equals Ruiz. It's the same person, basically. Somebody just wants the big boss in the end. It isn't that they want this important but mid-level person. They want the big boss. The Mexicans are just harsher about how they deal with it by torturing a guy to the point where he does the, it's the good cop, bad cop routine. Salazar goes in there, the one who ordered all this in the first place. Oh, no, what'd they do to you? And then he sits down with them, and they always say during the war on terror, I guess it's still going on, but the Abu Ghraib stuff, how unnecessary that was, they say that if you just talk to a terror suspect or anybody who's your suspect, you'll get way further than if you try to torture or hurt them. Well, he does get tortured and hurt first, but then when Salazar just talks to him and feeds him, he gives up stuff immediately.
I love that scene. I think I noticed his performance more this time because I recognize that actor now from other things.
Clifton Collins Jr.
Yeah, notably from Westworld. And the moment where he gives in and he just writes the names down quickly before he can even think about it, and he has this relief, but it's not even relief. It's almost like a new sickening reality that's setting in. He realizes his world has changed forever. But the physicality of his character that he's created, and it's so different from other roles I've seen him in, he's a really good character actor. There's so many great performances in this movie, though, too. And I think a thing that Soderbergh maybe doesn't get a ton of credit for is he's obviously really, really gifted at getting good performances out of actors.
Maybe that's one reason he won Best Director, because is it the best directed movie of that year? That might very well be Ang Lee for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. I don't think it was Ridley Scott in Gladiator. Not that Soderbergh was a bad choice. He was up against himself for Aaron Brockovich. That's only happened a few times ever, and it hadn't happened for decades. Maybe something like 60 years at that point.
How wild is it that he made those two movies in a single year? Perhaps two of the movies he is best known for.
And they're both huge hits. I've never been the biggest Aaron Brockovich fan. We watched Civil Action not long ago because I want you to see the movie that came a couple years before. And the same basic storyline that I certainly like a lot more. I don't know if you agree with that. I think Brockovich is good.
I like Brockovich better.
And it's a solid movie. I just don't think it's as good as everyone else thinks it is. But okay, fine. That was a big night for him at the Oscars because Julia Roberts won for that as Best Actress. And then Del Toro for Supporting Actor in his other movie of that same year.
Yeah, he was like an up-and-comer for a long time. And he had all these films that everybody was really excited about. I think it was Roger Ebert said this in his review. This is the film where he fulfilled the promise of films like Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Out of Sight and The Limey.
I remember him saying at some point that he couldn't set up another over-the-shoulder shot. He'd shoot himself in the head if he had to do that anymore. Around that time frame, I think it was the mid to late 90s, we were getting tired of it. He produced Pleasantville. We talked about that a few years ago. He was one of the big producers on that. I'm assuming helped shepherd the project through. I don't think he was just a producer. I think he was one of the reasons that movie got made, period. But then he goes on in the years to follow. Well, the same year, Out of Sight is Pleasantville. And then I like The Limey a lot. I know you don't. But then the two big movies in 2000, Ocean's 11. I think Solaris is pretty good. Look at his filmography. We talked about that a lot on Contagion. Somebody says in the movie, I think it's during the Mexico sequences with Del Toro and all those guys, where the reason why they keep trying to push drugs across the border, and they do get caught plenty of times, is because the risk is worth the reward. They don't necessarily say this directly, but they're drug mules. They don't really give a shit about them. So if they're caught or killed, I guess the risk they have to worry about is maybe they would sell them out. But I'm sure what they would do is they can't really be traced back to the big bosses.
Yeah, they insulate it. I think he said we just find somebody with nothing to lose and we get them to drive drugs over the border.
And there's so much money in it that even if you lost, I don't know how much it'd be, $5 million on that shipment, you might get 80 or even just 10 the next day. So easily, clearly, it's worth it. And there's so many drugs that you can bring because there's so many drugs that are grown. Grown? Is that the right word for it?
Yeah, no. Produced.
Well, the drug's first grown and then, yeah, it's processed anyway, down south of the border. Okay, let's go back to the Cincinnati stuff for the Wakefields. One of the touches I like a lot is when Robert's in the back of the car and he reacts to Caroline saying about, she's talking to her friends and said, my dad's the fucking drug czar. And he has a reaction, my daughter just said fucking. He doesn't say anything. He never says that to Amy Irving, who plays his wife later on in the movie. Is Caroline swearing? What's this? But he has a look on his face as if to say, my little girl swears. Little does he know what's about to be happening. And she's already started doing it. She was doing drugs before the scene we see where she does the freebasing.
There's clearly a dynamic in the family that he doesn't really know what's going on with his family, that his wife and his daughter have a closer relationship. She's aware of what's going on. So she's not shocked when her daughter swears. And you kind of get the impression that maybe when he's not around, they have a whole different dynamic between the two of them. It's clearly something much more permissive.
Which was true about your mom.
It's true, the dynamic.
You were around the same age. Your dad, yeah. You don't really like swearing around him even now, and you're 42 years old.
But I'll swear with my mom. And yeah, when I was 16 years old, well, that's around the time my parents split up too. So my dad wasn't around. My mom, it was a free-for-all. My dad joked that she was Athens and he was Sparta. It's a very nerdy dad joke. That was very appropriate coming from my dad.
An important line that he has, Douglas does, with his guys, though, when they've been down to Mexico and seen what's going on down there and trying to find out what really can be happening with this. And, of course, they're not really finding out the details because Salazar's pretending like he's actually trying to stop the drug trade, even though he's trying to benefit from it financially. But he does say on the flight with his people back to Washington, on this flight only, the dam is open for new ideas. What I love about that scene is that nobody says anything, but they do cut away too soon. The editing in this movie won the Oscar, and Mirion's editing is excellent. Well, you always know where you are, partly because of the color filters, I think, because the actors don't really cross over. It's not that hard to figure out, well, this is a different part of the world when Douglas is on screen. He does go to Mexico, granted, but when he says that, it almost should have been that hold for at least 3 seconds where they all look at each other, don't even look at each other, don't say anything. Maybe that was in the original cut, and Soderbergh realized, we got the point, they have nothing to contribute, but it almost should have been a laugh moment where in the theater it's nothing, 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 and then maybe a really slow fade out would have worked too. So I like that scene, but I think it could have been even better. But it's also funny that an important guy like him, a smart person, seems like a decent person, would say that on this flight only, let them contribute anything they might. Yay. Maybe the next week they thought, you know what, Bob, I was thinking about this. You can't contribute that anymore.
Why should it be a special occasion for them to be able to pipe up and contribute ideas? He has demonstrated very much that he has no idea himself what to do about this problem. The more he learns about it, the more he seems out of his league.
Which I think he knows. When he first meets with Albert Finney, who plays the chief of staff, so he's the president's chief of staff, and he's been told all the things that are going on, you realize this job is more ceremony and bullshit. And of course, he has that great scene with James Brolin, who was the previous drug czar. And Brolin says, write two letters. One, which is blaming me for everything, and the other one, which is
write
two more letters, yeah, because you're out. Anyway, while all this is going on, of course, we see Carolyn, cross-cut through the whole film, becoming a full-on drug whore. And she starts doing needles. Another one of her great moments as a young actress where the drug dealer, her, I guess, boyfriend, pimp, whatever he has become at this point, pulls out some needles. She sees that he has them in his bag. She wasn't doing needles at this point. I think it's the suggestion. She was probably still freebasing. And he pulls it out to say, you want this? And she just has this look, yeah, that goes into me. And then she's really screwed. And during that whole sequence, I noticed too, much like in Taxi Driver, the red letter scene in that movie, which is, you talking to me? You also hear people in the other apartments just living their lives. I think you almost hear what they're saying. So the Scorsese thing where he's got people living their lives while these people are going nuts, doing awful things. Well, same thing with this. Caroline is hearing, if she wanted to pay attention, normal life going around while she is throwing her life right down the toilet because something inside of her is broken and she has to put drugs in her system.
I have to say that her story to me, it just doesn't work.
Like, really?
Okay, so she's smart. She's wealthy. She's privileged. Her parents love her. They're still married. So I feel like I need maybe a little more explanation for why she's this messed up. She feels, like you say, very realistic, like a teenager.
She's mad.
They cast a teenager to play a teenager, which I find so refreshing. I hate when they cast, like, 28-year-olds to play teenagers. But she lies to her parents the way that I used to lie to my parents. She makes it really believable. And she knows that they're already inclined to believe that she's a well-behaved kid, to be shocked when she swears. But her story, in my opinion, is just the most ridiculous story in the film. It's reefer madness. She goes from a student to a drug-addled whore in what feels like a week and a half. And I know it's not. Let's say it's 6 months. That is still a ridiculous timeline. Just from the point of view that she wouldn't run out of money that fast. Somebody who's that wealthy, she has all kinds of ways that she could get money before she would have to resort to prostituting herself.
She does steal from them. They realize that she's come in at some point and stolen a lot of stuff.
She would hit her friends up for money. There's other things she could do before she would have to resort to something that low. Drug addicts don't immediately become these drug-seeking zombies. They can still think and manipulate and strategize and fool people for many, many, many years before people start to really catch on just how bad their behavior is. But she seems to go from a student. How are you that high functioning?
Aha, I have an answer to that.
Okay.
Stephen Gagan, who wrote this movie and adapted it from the Traffic with a K miniseries, the English one from, I think, the late 80s. He said that when he was a student in Kentucky, that he was a straight-A student and also had a drug problem. Probably not like this, but he was, I think, a drug addict, and yet he was a straight-A student. So when people question that, how can she do this? How can she manage to make this work? Well, he did.
Well,
he literally did.
Her father is a high-functioning alcoholic. I would believe it if at the end of the film, she was still an A student. It just feels a reality test, and it feels like it's moralizing. The film is hardly innocent in the sense that it's trying to give you the most dramatic storylines and moralizing about, yes, that's okay, drugs are bad.
Requiem for a Dream does the same thing.
Requiem for a Dream, I have the same criticism. This is reefer madness. Good Lord, people don't fall downhill, or they go downhill, they don't fall off a cliff the way they do in that film and the way that she does in this film. It dates the film because I think back around the turn of the century, if I may, around year 2000, this was kind of a popular attitude about drugs. We still grew up with those assemblies. Cops did come to my school and basically insinuate that if I smoked a marijuana cigarette, I was going to be in prison by the end of the semester. We all just kind of accepted that storyline that the consequences are that dramatic and that fast. And now that we know a lot more about drugs, or I should say, we're just less susceptible to propaganda. I think propaganda has lost its power now in 2020, maybe because white people have the drug problem now and not black people. I actually believe that. I'm not saying that cynically. I think that part of the reason we have realistic attitudes about drug addiction is because the current drug problem is affecting white communities. So we just take a much more empathetic view towards it. So that's just another thing that dates the film. It's probably less like a failure on the writer's part than it is a failure on the 90s.
Maybe I like that sequence or the whole thing with Wakefield so much because I think the performances are outstanding. It's one of the best things
Absolutely.
Douglas has ever done. Douglas has done these kinds of movies where he goes down a moral toilet, if you will, his sex movies from long ago, where he's this clean-cut, rich, world-by-the-balls type of guy, does something wrong, maybe doesn't even do anything wrong, and then at the end he's looking like he does in this movie, effectively, if not worse off. Christensen's pretty great. I think it's the best thing Topher Grace has ever done. His movie debut, he was young as well at this point. That 70s show was around that same time frame. So maybe that's what it is for me. I think Amy Irving, despite a very small amount of screen time, we covered her in Carrie years ago, is quite good as the wife too. So I guess that's why it works for me pretty well. And again, when you read that the actual writer had something in common with this character, maybe not quite as over the top as this, that's what I buy more so. One thing I'm sure I've brought up in other podcasts too is the scene in this when Robert finally finds her. And she has that weird moment, too, where she's so high, but she has her arm turned over almost like it's, I can't even do it, you know, where she's laying face down on the bed.
Contorted.
When he finds her and he starts crying and he's over her. I think I've mentioned before that I love the way that Soderbergh gets the hell out of the room and the camera's outside as if it's Seth's point of view. He's going to watch this and he walks away. Seth realizes this is not for me. I helped him find her. He's going to get her out of here.
He probably was afraid of
her. I might
her
get beat up, too. But anyway, the point being,
or arrested. He's a judge.
No, but he even says, maybe it's one of the deleted scenes. You're not going to be in trouble. You got to help me. This is not about you. And I'm not going to tell your parents. I don't care about any of that stuff. You just got to help me find my daughter. But anyway, I always talked about how the camera's outside that whole time. No, the camera's in their space. But it's not right up his nose, either. And there's that point at the end where it does pull out as if to give them the respect. he's got to cry, but you don't need to see it right up close.
No.
So have some backing, as I've talked about before. Show them acting from behind. I think it's one of the best moments in the movie. It isn't quite as good as I thought it was before, though, because the camera is in with them at one point in that sequence. A few more things about Benicio del Toro. We've covered him before on The Usual Suspects, and of course he's Mr. Quirky, always has been. I was reading he didn't even speak Spanish before this movie. I think he's speaking it pretty well, so that's a credit to him there as
but
well.
But he speaks Spanish in Puerto Rico.
No, but he didn't speak Spanish. He may be Puerto Rican, but that's what I was reading. He doesn't speak Spanish.
Even if he did speak Spanish, it would be probably a dramatically different accent, I imagine.
Well, if that got out in the press details, maybe that's one reason why people gave him the supporting actor Oscar. Because he's quite good in the film, and maybe the idea is he represents the entire cast as good as they all are. But if you're going to go between him and, say, Joaquin Phoenix in Gladiator or other performances that year, I wouldn't necessarily pick this one. It's good, although, then again, Willem Dafoe in Shadow of the Vampire. That was my probably favorite performance of that year. He plays Max Schreck.
Yeah, that's a pretty competitive field.
There's also some small roles of people before they're all that well-known. Viola Davis, who'd worked with Soderbergh a lot at this time, is the social worker that Christensen says. She's so mad, she tells her that. John Slattery's in the movie as a lawyer as well. And then, of course, Benjamin Bratt is Obregon, one of the other drug cartel leaders. Salma Hayek has a small role. And as I said to you when you see her on screen, she's one of the biggest stars in this whole movie at that time because some of them were yet to be big players. Like Don Cheadle wasn't really a star yet. He'd been in a lot of good movies but was still thought of as a character actor. We talked a lot about Soderbergh already. His writer, Steven Gagan, has only written 7 screenplays ever. He wrote and directed Syriana 5 years after this, which I like quite a bit. Clooney won the supporting actor Oscar for that. And then he wrote, and maybe even directed, but definitely wrote, Doolittle earlier this year, which we haven't seen, but that looked like it was going to be terrible. And we don't know if it was, but he's a good writer and only 7 screenplays. Maybe you don't think he was a good writer with... Well, what do you think? Is
well, I never saw Dr. Doolittle.
But I mean, based on this winning the Oscar, was this worthy?
Yeah, if you don't like the screenplay. I think it's wonderful.
But you don't love the Carolyn stuff.
One misstep, but God, there's just so many gems in the screenplay. There's so much great dialogue and telling 3 stories the way they do. Real innovation at the time. It's one of those things that's been copied many times, but the method of telling all these different stories concurrently, it was a pretty innovative thing to do. And that was in the screenplay.
And even though you don't like the look of the film, the filters definitely help that too. Because we keep everyone straighter that
way. Oh, listen, I'm not against filtering and color coding one scene or another. I just think that the execution was terrible.
Well, also Soderbergh, I think, from this movie on, because he started being his own cinematographer, but I think was also his own operator. So there's an awful lot of handheld camera in here, too. And maybe that doesn't help either. Oh, I love the shot, and I think it's handheld. But regardless, when the helicopter, Douglas is going into wherever it is, I think it's Mexico, as it comes towards the camera and it kind of turns over, if you will. It's like a Scorsese kind of shot, the kind of thing he might do as the helicopter comes down towards the camera.
I think it's appropriate. It's like a docudrama, so it puts you right there in the center of all the action. I don't have a problem with the handheld camera stuff. And he doesn't overdo it like some people overdo it, where you get nauseated watching it.
His producers were Edward Zwick, Marshall Herskovitz, and Laura Bickford. Zwick won an Oscar as a producer on Shakespeare in Love, which we covered quite a few years ago, and also directed Glory, which we've talked about before. He's a pretty good director. He's done his own good movies. I liked Legends of the Fall. I like Courage Under Fire. Herskovitz always works with Zwick, or at least often does, and Laura Bickford was involved in Che with Soderbergh many years later, where Del Toro played Che. And Matt Damon's in that movie briefly as well, for that matter, because Damon's in almost everything that Soderbergh directs, it seems, since Ocean's 11. The movie's 185:1. We watched the Blu-ray, which we already said didn't look that great. We talked about Soderbergh being his own cinematographer. The editor, Steven Mirione, worked... I think it's Mirione. Maybe it's Mirione. But he cut Contagion, which we talked about not long ago, and Birdman, which we did last year, and then a lot of other movies with Clooney and Soderbergh. So I guess they just keep on recruiting him for their films. And the composer, Cliff Martinez, Soderbergh says that on the commentaries. I've heard him say that a few times. Cliff Martinez, not Martinez. So anyway, did music for Contagion, which I think we liked quite a bit, and also Drive, and then often works with Soderbergh and quite well, I think, in this movie too. His music score, that helicopter scene, very effective stuff. The music that's playing when Ray gets blown up in the car bomb, pretty effective stuff. I think the only stereo sound effect in this, or at least 5.1 sound effect, is the music. I don't think any of the sounds are... I think I read that somewhere, that in addition to the movie looking the way it does, it's also got an old-fashioned mono mix, except for the music.
Oh, wow.
I didn't really notice that. I think that's true, though.
I can't talk about Soderbergh without talking about the fact that his films are like my favorite edited films. I just love the part that they got this film greenlit with a 165-page script, and they still managed to get it down to 145 minutes, and apparently the first cut was like 190 minutes. I just think that he respects keeping it short. You keep talking about the deleted scenes, but respect to a director who has the power to keep that stuff in, because it was greenlit as a long film to begin with, still chooses to cut it, and then has this wonderfully well-paced film that manages to incorporate 3 stories the way it does.
It doesn't feel long.
It's a tremendously well-cut film. He's a perfect editor. I know he's not his own editor, but His films are so well edited.
I think we said in Contagion that he's his own editor sometimes. And I said, no, he works with Mirion or someone. No, I think he actually since around this time, maybe soon after this, he started cutting his own films more often than not.
He's like a really deft touch for storytelling and trusting his audience to put together the story with what they see while he can just focus on the emotional beats. It can seem like it's harder to cut all these multiple storylines, but it's actually a bit of a cheat. It gives you all these options that you wouldn't necessarily have if you were telling a start to finish narrative story. If you feel the pace is lagging one way or the other, you have all these options you wouldn't necessarily have if you just had a straightforward narrative, but still really, really wonderfully done.
And also credit to him, because I remember after this movie came out and he had such success by winning the Oscar and two huge hits in the same year, that he said to people he knew, I'm going to take advantage of all this stock I have right now in Hollywood, so let's get stuff made. And he produced a lot of movies he didn't direct. I'm pretty sure he's involved with Syriana, Stephen Gagan directing, I think maybe his first movie, or if not his first, maybe a second movie. Probably doesn't get made at all if it doesn't have Soderbergh's name behind it. So you love to see that, when somebody gets some power in Hollywood and uses it for the right reasons.
Well, and producers probably love him because he comes in under budget, too. He reminds me so much of Robert Rodriguez in the sense that he just seems like a guy who's determined to make movies, loves movies, doesn't necessarily love working within the system, but can take advantage of the system to get done what they want to get done. And whether you're fans of theirs or not, if you love cinema, you have to respect their passion and their approach in one way or another.
We finally cover the guy twice in a matter of months this year. Maybe we'll do some of his other films as the years go on. There's a ton of them we could choose from. He's made a lot of duds, but he's made a lot of other movies that are, if not great, then quite good. Like Out of Sight, for example. And you like Aaron Brockovich. I think The Limey's quite good.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Of course.
We're just talking about his older films. He's made more recent films that are great, too, that we've really enjoyed. Behind the Candelabra, and we both love The Informant.
Mm-hmm. Or Damon's probably the funniest he's ever been. But we haven't done What Happens Next yet. I said I was going to do that towards the end. We don't always wait till the end, but I did this time. So because of that bug under the desk that Montel planted when he pretended to get in a fight with the security guards at the Ayala house, he gets more evidence against Carl, but either Carl beats the rap again or some other drug lord swoops in and takes over his territory about 90 seconds after Carl goes down, because that's what's going to happen.
I'll add that next time Montel is the one who gets blown up with the car bomb.
Maybe so. And also Caroline relapses a few more times, I think. This isn't over for her. All right, last thoughts on Traffic.
Well, I can and I will gripe about the cinematography, but it's one chance that Soderbergh took in a very gutsy film that didn't pay off, but just about everything else that he tried here does pay off very well. It's certainly a film of its time and place, but it remains really watchable, smart, and vital. I think it's a great film.
Yeah, it's complicated and it can be confusing, but four, maybe even five viewings, I think I might have it straight now.
It's just the Mexico storyline that
It's mostly that. It's true. Partly because you have a different language and we don't really know most of those actors other than Del Toro. And yes, the movie deserved to be better shot than it is for such important subject matter and so well directed and acted. But it remains a powerful film. The cast is terrific, especially Christensen, who I think is outstanding, best thing she's ever done. Cheadle is quite good. Del Toro winning the Oscar. Douglas is great. I think Zeta Jones is better than I used to think she is in this movie after seeing it here again. And 20 years later, it's still a home run of a movie. And if I had to relitigate those Oscars, I felt that way then, I still do now. This should have won Best Picture and won all five of its nominations that night.
Well, it's better than Gladiator.
That's true. And we liked Gladiator. We thought it was a fine film. But this is better and, more importantly, more important. Okay, in 7 days, it will be June the 1st. And that will mark exactly 30 years to the day that Total Recall was released. So let's get our ass to Mars and give these people air by covering Total Recall. The coming attraction's opinion for Total Recall. Was the whole plot just a fantasy implanted in Arnold's head, just as he wanted when he went to Recall? Or was it all real? Did it all really happen?
All right, so for our answers, tune into our next podcast about Total Recall. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Please favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and many, many more on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, please leave us a rating and a review that helps people find us. Ryan and I are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
If you didn't like this podcast, write two letters. Blame me, and then, well, blame me again.
Aww.
I welcome you to take the Trump approach.
And cut.